It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrard. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a look at the fallout from this weekend's political news and what's happening in the polls with Harry Enten from 538.com.
First, a federal judge is hearing a challenge to Wisconsin's voter ID law today. The hearing centers on the ID petition process. The process is aimed at helping people who don't have the proper documentation get IDs to vote.
The plaintiff in the case, One Wisconsin Institute, is asking the judge to either suspend the state's voter ID law or put in place measures to address problems with the ID petition process. In addition to the hearing, Democratic members of the Wisconsin Election Commission are asking the court to appoint new attorneys. They say the state's Department of Justice would not file a report with the court on their behalf.
Ken Mayer joins us to talk about all this. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He also served as an expert witness for the plaintiffs in this case, One Wisconsin Institute. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
Well, a federal judge is hearing an additional challenge to Wisconsin's voter ID law today. Can you give us the latest?
What is happening today is the federal judge, Judge Peterson, has scheduled a hearing to deal with issues that have come up in the last couple of weeks about the recordings and the filings from the plaintiffs in the One Wisconsin case that the Department of Transportation and the DMV is not complying with the judge's order that the DMV provide IDs to people who present asking for an ID for voting purposes and requires them to provide the ID even if the people requesting them don't have all the documentation like a birth certificate and some of the other documentation that was originally required by the Department of Transportation to produce an ID. And even under the alternative process called the ID petition program or process that was designed to or that was presented as a way of providing IDs to people who don't have all of the underlying documentation, what the recordings demonstrate and what One Wisconsin lawyers are arguing is that the DMV is giving inaccurate information. They're not providing the IDs as they had promised the judge that they would do, and they're not complying with the judge's original order, which was that the state basically make it easier and facilitate the process of people who don't have a birth certificate, who don't have all of the documentation that the state was originally requiring, that they still have to be given an ID for voting purposes.
And the state was given by Judge Peterson, I believe, a week to gather a report and come back to the court, say what they find, and what has the state found?
Well, I actually haven't seen that report, but the newspaper coverage was that they did their own investigation with staff going to DMV and requesting information, and they said that they found that a number of people were still giving incorrect information. But their report argued that the process is working well. But it seems pretty clear that here we are a month before the election, and people for whom there is no question about their identity, they still are having difficulty getting the ID that's necessary, the photo ID that's necessary for them to vote.
What is One Wisconsin Institute asking Judge Peterson for today?
Well, they're asking for a couple of different things. One of the things they're asking is specific types of relief that make explicit orders to the DMV that they have to do certain things. Another is that if he can't do that, there are other people who are asking him to suspend the voter ID law for the November election. And I've seen some accounts of the hearing as it's ongoing that he's pretty unhappy about how this has worked out, even though he has expressed some doubts whether he has the authority to simply suspend the law. But it is pretty amazing and, in my view, completely unacceptable that we're just before the election and people are still having difficulty getting over this hurdle, which is unnecessary in any event. But there are people who are going to be disenfranchised who are not going to be able to vote because of the difficulty of getting an ID and the lack of clarity about what precisely they need to do.
What kind of outreach and education has been provided to voters so far about the new voter ID law? Because that was a part of the stipulation, that there had to be some sort of education aspect.
Right. So there really hasn't been much from the State Elections Commission or state agencies. I think I saw that they spent a couple hundred thousand dollars on voter education. That's plainly insufficient. Virtually all of the effort to mobilize and educate and identify and assist people has come from nonprofit groups, vote writers, One Wisconsin, League of Women Voters, and so forth, trying to assist people in navigating this process. But it really is incredible to me that we're here a month before the election, and there's still people who are not able to get IDs as the state has been ordered to by a federal judge. And one of the things that research has shown on voter ID is voters are often confused. And so what is likely to happen is that even if the judge issues explicit orders that fix the immediate problem, it is almost a certainty, in fact, I would say it's a certainty, that there are going to be voters who are confused about what the requirements are and would believe that they can't meet the requirements when they actually can. And the result is that there are people who are going to be prevented from voting in November for no reason.
We're talking with Ken Mayer right now. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison, and we're talking about the latest in Wisconsin's voter ID law and a hearing that's going on today with a federal judge. And what are the options for Judge Peterson today to decide?
Well, I think he could issue against specific instructions and try to lay out explicitly what the DMV does in clearer terms. He could suspend the law, even though he apparently has said he doesn't think he can do that. There are a variety of different types of relief that he could provide, but I think the immediate goal of the plaintiffs in this case is to find a way for the judge to get the Department of Transportation to comply with the orders that he has already issued and make sure that people are getting accurate information. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know specifically what types of relief are specifically on the table, but I think that's what the lawyers for the plaintiffs are looking for is a way to fix this problem.
Now, there's another layer on this we haven't talked about yet. Two Democratic members of the state's newly formed Elections Commission are asking the court to appoint them new attorneys. In broad strokes, what do you see going on there?
Well, I think that's probably an issue that can arise when you have a bipartisan, people of different parties in an agency or in an official government department. The lawyers for the Department of Justice represent the state, and they represent state agencies. And when you have an internal dispute in the agency, the State Elections Commission is made up of both Democrats and Republicans, and the Democrats are clearly unhappy with the way that the state has responded to the judge's orders. And this is a way for them to try to put pressure on the Department of Justice and state attorneys to fix what they see as a problem. Yeah, I doubt that this will work. I don't think that this will succeed, and they will get the judge to order the state to appoint new attorneys. But to me, what it looks like is clearly a symptom of the unhappiness the Democrats on the State Elections Commission have with the way that the state agencies are implementing the judge's order or not implementing the judge's order. I find this incredible. I mean, we know from the April presidential primary that there were hundreds of people who tried to vote and were unable to vote. That, they cast provisional ballots and their votes were not counted because they didn't have an ID. And the claims that voter ID is necessary to prevent fraud are simply—they're just outrageously false. There's no evidence of that, and it's just amazing to me that you could have hundreds, if not thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of people who are going to try to vote in November and will be prevented from doing so because they don't have an ID.
Well, thank you for your time.
Okay.
That was Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison, and he joined us to talk about some of the issues surrounding Wisconsin's voter ID law as a challenge is playing out in a federal court today. He's an expert witness for the plaintiff in that case.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll hear about the campaign for the state legislature, key races, what's at stake, and why it matters to voters.
Right now, it's been a whole week since our last check-in with Harry Enten, and a lot has happened in the world of national politics.
The Access Hollywood tapes came out. WikiLeaks dropped more hacked Clinton emails. Then the second debate and a public feud between Donald Trump and some key members of his own party. The newest polls are just starting to show the public reaction to all that presidential campaign news.
Harry Enten is back with us. He's a senior editor at 538.com. Harry, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, what's the latest in polling national key states after this eventful week?
Well, it seems that what we saw after the first debate, Hillary Clinton rising, that rise has not abated yet. She's up to her highest point in the national poll since she was after the Democratic National Convention, which, of course, was the highest she's been this entire campaign. She's up by about 7 percentage points nationally, according to our polls-only model. And if you look across the swing states, she leads in all of the key swing states. And, in fact, she may be leading in some states that are unusual that we wouldn't even expect her to be leading in. And that, you know, so it looks very good for her right now.
Utah. Talk about Utah.
Yeah, that's the state I'm alluding to, right? There's a new poll out from the state of Utah by a polling organization, which is not a terrible polling organization, which has Hillary Clinton tied with Donald Trump at 26%. Now, you may say 26% each of them getting only adds up to 52%. Where is all the other vote? Well, Evan McMullen, who is a name that we don't really speak about a lot, he was a Republican operative who decided to throw his hat into the ring because he was so unsatisfied with Donald Trump. He is getting 22% of the vote in that state, and there was a lot of talk of some Republican, high-ranking Republican officials in that state backing Evan McMullen instead of Donald Trump. And then you have Gary Johnson, who's at 16%. So you basically have a four-way race in that state, and whoever wins there could win with, say, 33, 34% of the vote, something very unusual.
That is unusual, and it's been an unusual week. We had those tapes released on Friday, and then the debates, and that certainly came up there. Let's give a little listen.
No, I didn't say that at all. I don't think you understood what was said. This was locker room talk. I'm not proud of it. I apologize to my family. I apologize to the American people. Certainly, I'm not proud of it. But this is locker room talk.
So Trump's saying he wasn't talking about sexual assault, just locker room talk. This kicked off a lot of reaction, the tape itself, from a lot of prominent Republicans. Can you talk about some of the latest back and forth on that?
Yeah, I mean, let's just say that this is something different that we've never really seen before, right? You expect parties to coalesce around this time if they're divided. This party seems to be dividing, not coalescing, and we've seen people from Kelly Ayotte, who's the Republican senator from New Hampshire, saying she can't vote for Donald Trump. That's a key race. In Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey is saying he's undecided. He's not sure whether he's going to vote for Donald Trump. And then you see Donald Trump going after Paul Ryan, despite the fact that Ryan is not unendorsing Trump, but he hasn't exactly said a lot of kind things about Donald Trump. To me, this is a Republican Party that is divided, and divided parties just don't win presidential elections, which is why we have Donald Trump at such a low percentage to win right now.
Let's give a listen to Paul Ryan talking at a rally this weekend that Donald Trump was scheduled to go to, was uninvited to go to. Mike Pence, I don't know the whole story there. He ended up not coming as planned. Here's a brief bit from Paul Ryan.
Here in Wisconsin, we will deliver our 10 electoral votes. We will fight for our conservatives, and we will offer this country solutions, and we will meet the moment for what it is.
So we will deliver our 10 electoral votes. Usually that sentence would end for Donald Trump or for our candidate. He was strangely vague there, and in a talk with congressional Republicans, a bit vague, but saying he wouldn't defend Trump. He wouldn't campaign with him. This is like the highest elected Republican official in the country talking about his party's candidate.
Boy, I tell you, King Solomon would be proud of Paul Ryan trying to slice this so many ways. It's so difficult to figure out exactly what he's thinking, but I think it's fairly clear, right? Paul Ryan doesn't like Donald Trump. really wishes Donald Trump weren't the nominee, but he is the Republican nominee. And there are a lot of Republican-based voters who like Donald Trump, and Paul Ryan recognizes that he needs those voters to come out to vote for Republican House candidates come the fall, while at the same time he himself doesn't want to be too attached to Trump. So he's kind of trying to split the baby both ways. I'm not sure it's actually going to work out for them. I mean, Republicans will likely hold the House, but that goes a long way in explaining why Paul Ryan basically sounds like a man who doesn't know what he wants.
Talking to Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com, looking at a wild week in presidential politics. And Harry, you've been talking about this, you and your colleagues at 538. Donald Trump seems to be really focusing on the same voters who won the primary for him. But is that going to be enough people to win a general election for him?
Not really. I mean, look, he won in the primary by getting, say, that 30 to 45%, depending on the primary vote, in particular states, that base vote, a lot of white voters without a college degree. And while they make up a significant portion of general election voters, they do not come anywhere close to making up a majority of them. And what you're seeing over and over again in polls is Trump coming in with 36, 37, 38, 39, maybe 40% of the vote. And although that was enough to win a divided Republican primary, Hillary Clinton right now is coming in with numbers 45, 46, 47% of the vote. And therefore, she is the favorite. And Donald Trump seems to be doubling down on a strategy that worked before, but almost certainly will not work again.
Right. Donald Trump says the shackles are off. He's not letting Republicans hold him back anymore. And one idea out there is that, okay, instead of trying to reach out to voters in the middle, undecided voters, whatever, he's giving up on that. And he's going to try to release and talk as much as he can about Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton to try to dissuade Clinton supporters from coming out to the vote. People have called it scorched earth, various things. Is there anything out there that shows that a strategy like that might work?
Not really. We know that Democratic enthusiasm, if anything, is up over the past few weeks since the first debate. If you look at a state like North Carolina, where we're getting early vote numbers, what it in fact shows is Democrats are showing up with about the same numbers that they did 4 years ago, but it's Republicans who seem to be staying home. There is absolutely no proof at all, looking at the polls right now, that Democrats are staying home. If anything, the indications are that Republicans are staying home.
One of your newest pieces looks at the history of presidential races to say, okay, looking at where Donald Trump is in the polls, you know, a month out basically from Election Day, is there a precedent for somebody making that big a comeback? So is there?
Not really. You know, Donald Trump right now in our polls only forecast is down by about 6.5 points or 6.6 points, nearly 7 percentage points. The polls at this point, there's only one race there with a margin closed by more than that margin, that 6.5 points, and that was in 1992 when Bill Clinton was leading by double digits and he ended up winning by mid-single digits. But Bill Clinton still won that race. That race was very different than this one. The things that have tended to perhaps move the polls a lot have been debates. We've already had two of those. Donald Trump lost both of those debates, according to the polls, and viewership was down for the second one. So I don't really quite understand how a third debate, where he hasn't won the first two, and a third debate in which there'll be fewer viewers, is going to be able to change this race around for him.
On Hillary Clinton's side, more and more WikiLeaks revelations coming out, what she said in some of those speeches to Wall Street, Big Wheels, internal campaign emails, a lot of stuff that people are saying is pretty embarrassing for her campaign. Is it the kind of stuff that is going to move voters?
Well, you know, if this were a normal campaign, if this were one in which Donald Trump was not the Republican nominee, that's all we'd be talking about. But the fact is, when you have somebody who's been caught on tape suggesting committing sexual assault, that will dominate the news headlines. And Donald Trump just can't get out of his own way. I've said all along that whichever candidate is in the news is the candidate that is losing. And Donald Trump continues to dominate the news headlines. Ergo, Donald Trump continues to fall in the polls.
Big picture, something you've been thinking about, a lot of people thinking about, is win or lose, what does Donald Trump's candidacy mean for the future of the Republican Party? And I saw you made a really interesting point. We a lot of times think of Republicans as a coalition. Fiscal conservatives think Paul Ryan. Social conservatives think Ted Cruz, say. You're saying fiscal conservatives may be out in the cold. Now it's social versus cultural conservatives like Donald Trump and his followers. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, so, you know, social conservatives, we all know what those are. Those are, you know, a large part born-again, evangelical, white Christians. You know, Ted Cruz did very well with them in the primary. We've had a long history of them. But cultural conservatives, Ann Coulter is kind of a cultural conservative. Donald Trump is the same, where it's It's not really about fiscal policy. It's not really about abortion necessarily. It's issues like immigration and wanting to make America back to what it was, say, 50 years ago. Just this idea of an America lost. And that's really what keeps Donald Trump together, right? I mean, he's changed his position on taxes. He's changed his position on abortion. But the thing that's been consistent is that, well, we're getting killed overseas in free trade, and we're getting killed with immigration coming into this country. And what we have seen is that voters who voted for Donald Trump overwhelmingly listed immigration as their top issue, while the rest of the stuff didn't matter. And they are now making up a substantial portion of the Republican Party. And come 2020, I'd be very interested to see if the primary again comes down to a candidate like Ted Cruz, who is a social conservative, and a cultural conservative candidate, whoever it is.
So is there room in that Republican Party of 2020 for an old-fashioned fiscal conservative like, say, Paul Ryan?
Well, I think, you know, obviously there is a potential. We're still 4 years away, and I wouldn't be shocked if there's a cultural conservative candidate or a socially conservative candidate who adopts many of the same fiscal conservative issues. But I think that whoever's going to win the primary come 2020 is going to have to win at least some of either the social or cultural conservatives, especially if they're a fiscal conservative like Ryan is.
You don't see this as a one-off weird year for Republicans just based on this, what seemed at the outset, unlikely story of Donald Trump?
Well, of course, it could be a one-off. You never know if something is going to be a one-off. But the fact is that if you look at the long-term trends within the Republican Party and the voters who make up that Republican Party, which we, in fact, have done, we did a story, The End of a Republican Party, that was co-written with my colleague Claire Malone, we see that this is a long time coming. And if you just look back to 4 years ago with Mitt Romney, the thing that tied Mitt Romney to Donald Trump, where they were the two most anti-illegal immigration candidates in the field, and that seems to be an issue in which a lot of Republicans are voting on these days.
We'll leave it there for this week, Harry. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com.
Coming up after the news, the race for the state legislature has been flying under the radar in the midst of this hotly contested presidential campaign. We'll look at the key races and issues coming up. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we get the results of the Marquette University Law School poll released today and hear how Wisconsin feels about the presidential and Senate candidates, along with key policy issues.
First, the presidential and Senate races are getting a lot of attention, but there's a major election closer to home that could have a big impact on life here in Wisconsin.
The state legislature is up for grabs, and voters around the state will weigh in to see if Republicans will keep control of both chambers of the legislature.
You can follow these races. This is at wisconsinvote.org. Sean Johnson joins us now with a look at the race and some key matchups. He's WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, as we mentioned, Republicans currently control both the State Assembly and the State Senate. Can you give us the numbers there?
So in the State Senate, it's a 19-14 Republican majority. In the State Assembly, it's even bigger, a 63-36 seat majority. And they, aside from a very small period, kind of around the time of those recalls, Republicans have had majorities in Wisconsin's legislature since that 2010 wave election when they took power. And one of the things that's been able to help them keep that power is they got to redraw the political maps in 2011. And that is the playing field, basically, that candidates for the state legislature face today.
And how many seats are up for grabs in each chamber?
So in the assembly, every seat is officially up for election every couple of years. The whole shebang. However, there are just not that many competitive races in the assembly. In fact, a lot of races where there's only one choice. So, in theory, everybody's elected every 2 years in the assembly. In practice, it doesn't really play out that way. In the Senate, you've got half of the Senate up every couple of years. So they serve 4-year terms there.
And then I did a count. Half of half of the Senate is, just like you're saying, uncontested.
Right. And, you know, even those races that are contested where you have a Republican and a Democrat and they're out going to town halls and actively campaigning, you can make an argument in a lot of those races that just by the numbers, unless we see kind of a national wave election, they aren't all that competitive, many of them.
Now let's stop in the assembly for a moment. It sounds like from the numbers you gave, it would be a really tall order for Democrats to flip that side.
Yeah, they would need 14 seats to flip. So they'd need to have a net gain of 14 seats to have 50 to 49 majority in the state assembly. And, you know, it's just not going to happen.
The Vegas odds are not really Vegas actually did that.
Right. Vegas, I don't know. They're probably not looking at the Wisconsin Assembly.
The Assembly, yeah.
So it's just a really tall order for them, again, based on where they're starting, a 36-seat minority. And then just, you know, the map, again, is so key to the outcome of Assembly races. It would take... you know, we're really a political tsunami, whatever, you know, superlative you want to throw in there to change things in the assembly.
The Senate, though, from the numbers you gave, they'd only have to flip a few seats. Democrats would only have to flip a few seats to get a narrow majority there.
Yeah, even though the Senate is under that same map, it's always close in that you're only a few seats away. So in the Senate, Democrats would need to flip three seats to take back the majority. Jen Schilling, the Senate Democratic Minority Leader, said yesterday she thinks they're going to get 1-2. So she's not predicting we're going to ride in and take back everything, keeping the expectations manageable, I think, in the Senate. But Senator Schilling was saying, though, it kind of depends on what kind of a year this is. These local races get nationalized. And so... they haven't quite figured out what the Trump effect is going to be in Wisconsin and how it's going to affect races for Senate.
We'll get into that a little more with our next guest. But, Sean, are there some key Senate races that people are thinking, oh, these could be the ones that are really competitive?
Yeah, there are a few that Democrats are targeting. And the one that they've been targeting, you know, pretty much from the get-go, you knew it would be a competitive race, is the 18th state Senate district. And we actually have some sad news to report today in the 18th state Senate district. Outgoing Senator Rick Gudex, who had announced earlier this year he would not seek re-election, has died today from a self-inflicted gunshot to the chest. So, I mean, we mentioned that because we're talking about that race up there.
That particular seat, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's an investigation that's ongoing. Obviously, very sad news.
And his colleagues from both parties, we've seen a lot of tributes and condolences from them through the day today.
Yeah, you have from, you know, both sides of the aisle, people pouring out condolences. Very sad to hear what's happened to Senator Gudex. Who leaves behind a family.
Well, keeping that tragedy in mind, let's go to the politics of it.
To the politics of it, the 18th Senate district is a very close district by the numbers, and that's why no matter what happened, that was going to be one of those races that was really focused on this year. I mean, you look in 2012, which was the last time that seat was up. It was the last time we had a presidential election, and so the circumstances were the same. And Republicans won the seat with just over 50% of the vote. And so it's a close race. You have Winnebago County, which tends to go for Democrats up there, Fond du Lac, which goes for Republicans. And it's kind of a competition of which of those counties can turn out the vote and win the day to win that Senate seat.
And other Senate districts to watch.
Yeah, I think the next closest potentially Senate seat, or the one that Democrats would consider their number two target, would be the 14th Senate district, and that's currently held by Republican Senator Luther Olson. You know, this is not one that was close in 2012 exactly. Senator Olson had 56% of the vote. I mean, remember, 2012 was a pretty good year for Democrats. Barack Obama won Wisconsin handily, so it's not like the 14th Senate district is an easy haul for Democrats, but they've really focused on that this year. They've got a guy running up there who's the mayor of Waupaca, and Brian Smith, who Democrats feel like they've got a pretty decent shot with, and they've tried to focus on a couple issues with Senator Olson. One, the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King. There have been a number of complaints about the quality of care there, and they basically tried to lay that at Olson's doorstep. King is in the 14th Senate District. They've also tried to tie a number of these revelations that came out in the leaks as part of that John Doe investigation, that stuff that came out in The Guardian recently. They've tried to attach that to Olson as well because he was on the legislature's budget committee, which voted through some of the provisions related to lead paint, which were mentioned as part of that investigation.
Before I let you go, Sean, one of the big things at stake, a state budget coming out next year, could look really different if it's all Republicans in charge versus one of those chambers being in Democratic hands.
Yeah, absolutely. If it's a split legislature with a Republican governor, you know, it would give Democrats essentially a chance to stop whatever Governor Walker put out there, or at least influence it. And the last time we had a split legislature, split control, the budget got wrapped up in October, I believe. So you could see some serious gridlock if there's a two-party control. If it's all Republicans, I think you probably see some form of a continuation of what you've seen for the past several sessions.
Sean, thanks as always.
You're welcome, man.
That's WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Tim Dale joins us now for more on state legislative races. He's professor and chair of political science and public administration at UW La Crosse. Tim, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here.
Well, we got the lay of the land in this election. In general, Tim, do you see voters having a lot of focus and interest on these state legislative races?
Well, I think that voters are definitely interested in what happens in state legislative races. But as your question alludes to, voter fatigue at this point in Wisconsin and around the country may be affecting people's ability to pay attention. And so the exhaustion over hearing about the presidential race constantly, I think, tends to make people tune out of politics somewhat, and that may have a negative impact on people's willingness to become educated on their local races.
So given that, what sways a voter on these races? Is it seeing that D or R next to a candidate's name, or is it old-fashioned door-to-door campaigning or issues? What do people pay attention to the extent they pay attention?
Yeah, party identification is a really big factor, and so we definitely see the party affiliation probably having the most impact on people's voting, particularly because some of these local races are what we would call low information races, where the voters don't know a lot about the candidates. Certainly there is a percentage of voters who have followed the races closely, but really the deciding factor oftentimes comes down to which candidate is representing the party that's going to do well, and maybe even well on other parts of the ballot. And that's where we see that down ballot effect. That being said, there are all kinds of local issues, and Sean was just talking about several of them in several of those races, where people are known locally. They're known for their business practices. They're known for controversies they may have been involved in over the last few years. Local newspapers tend to cover those things fairly heavily. And so there certainly are issues. I think some of the races, probably more than others, have those local issues as central. But with so many other races going on at the state and national level, that's taken a lot of attention away.
Let's talk about the coattail effect that, say, a presidential candidate doing well or poorly might have. Does that end up affecting these state legislative races? And given a weird presidential year, what are you looking for this time?
Yeah, well, I think it's political scientists all over the country are watching with a lot of interest because we have theories and proven track records for predicting these things. But this may be the year that we have to rewrite all the textbooks. But for example, right now in the state of Wisconsin, both Feingold and Johnson are polling better than each of their respective presidential candidates. And that, so what that tells us is that there may be a coattails effect, but it might be for something like a Senate race and down ballot races more so than it would be for the presidential race. So if Johnson is going to have an impact on local Republican races, that might be where local Republicans want to look for a boost in their numbers. Same with Feingold. There's probably more enthusiasm in the state for those senatorial candidates within the respective parties than there is at the presidential side.
We're talking about the legislative elections in Wisconsin with Tim Dale. He's political science professor at UW La Crosse.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Are you paying attention to the assembly or state senate race in your area? Are you volunteering maybe for a campaign, or is this even on your radar? Is there a contest in your district? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our conversation with Tim Dale from UW La Crosse, looking at the campaign for Wisconsin State Legislature.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching the legislative contest in your area, your district? Are you involved in one, maybe as a campaign volunteer? Do you track these things, or are they usually under your radar? Or is there even a contest in your area? Do you have an uncontested seat? Do you think it should not be that way? And what do you think about redistricting and how it's affected Wisconsin's state legislative elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Tim, let's talk about those uncontested races. Lots of them. About, not quite, but about half of the seats up for grabs this year. There's one candidate on the ballot for people. What do you think about that?
Well, that is usually what happens if there's a perception that a race is not going to be competitive. And sometimes when you see the district lines being redrawn, the expectation of what effect that's going to have on the race in that particular district causes it to be very difficult for parties to recruit candidates. I don't think there's a single district where a party is happy that they don't have a candidate. Having that blank spot in press coverage, particularly when it comes to spending money on the other side, that's not a position a party wants to be in. But at the same time, there are logistical considerations that sometimes mean that those candidates are really hard to get onto the ballot when there's a perception of a non-competitive race.
As a political scientist, what do you think about the impact on our concept of representative government if there's, you know, no contest in so many districts?
Yeah, it definitely calls it into question, if not causes a problem for our defense of democracy. We like to have choices. That's how we know a decision has been democratic, when the choice exists. I think that people tend to feel comfortable overall, because even where you have non-competitive districts, the legislature is still competitive in the halls of government. And so it's an interesting twist to the American electoral system. When you have a first-past-the-post winner-take-all system, you end up with a competition that happens at the governmental level that you don't always get at the electoral level. And so when voters feel like they don't have a choice, there's a lot of disillusionment that happens. But then that choice sometimes becomes more clear when you see the legislative calendar start up and there's real competition over issues.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, I have a comment and wish your comment and your guest's response. In 2010, the Republicans gained control of both houses, the legislature and the governorship. And what they did is they used the conservative think tank ALEC, the American Legislative and Economic Council, to gerrymander radically all of Wisconsin's Senate and Assembly, state and Assembly seats, as well as its congressional districts. And for example, in 2012, 51% of Wisconsinites voted for Democrats in the Assembly, but only 37% were seated, which is now in the federal courts, because this is a brazen constitutional violation of the concept of one man, one woman, one vote. It's unethical, and I think it's both politically and morally disgusting. And I'd like to hear your guest response.
Jim, thanks for the call. And that is in the courts as part of a wider challenge to some changes in Wisconsin voting law, Tim. Jim finds it disgusting.
Well, and it certainly seems to fly in the face of the one person, one vote principle. The problem that the courts have had with getting rid of these gerrymandering practices is that the states are constitutionally protected to draw their own boundaries. And so it's also arguably a violation of the Constitution for the federal government to tell a state government how it ought to draw its district lines. And so it becomes an issue of federalism, and it kind of brings it into that more complicated sphere of politics. But on the face, it doesn't seem like good practice in a democracy, and yet any party who's in control, it works very hard to put things in their favor. And so this is definitely being worked out in the courts right now. And it's going to be really interesting to see what the future of this looks like, because voters certainly really have almost across the board become disgusted with practices that seem strange to them when it takes away their ability to have a voice in the process.
Jim, thanks for that call. We're talking about the campaign for Wisconsin State Legislature with Tim Dale, political scientist at UW-La Crosse. We go next to Carlene in Brooklyn. Carlene, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am a regular volunteer on sometimes organizer with campaigns. And one of the things that I've noticed in this cycle is that it's been a lot harder to recruit volunteers. I worked on Barack Obama's campaign both in 2008 and in 2012. And although I really appreciate the candidacy of a woman and that Russ Feingold is running again, the general electorate does not seem to be nearly as enthusiastic and excited about getting out and knocking on doors and things like that. So we have seen, just more apathy on the part of volunteers this time around than in the past. And so that's kind of upsetting.
Carlene, can I ask, you mentioned working for a presidential campaign. Have you worked on some of these local or legislative campaigns?
Absolutely, absolutely. In 2010, as a matter of fact, I'm south of Madison and worked really hard out here to help get Janice Ringhand elected. At that point, it was to the state assembly, and then also to the Senate. I live in the 80th Assembly District, and just like in some of the areas where it's strongly Republican, Sonny Pope is running unopposed right now, and I'm sure Republicans aren't very pleased about that, as I'm not very pleased about some districts where there's not a Democrat running for much. The same reasons that Professor Dale named.
And Carlene, I want to jump in and give Tim Dale a chance to respond. Thank you so much for sharing your experience and your observations. Seeing, Tim, not as many people getting involved in local campaigns, but also she's seeing more apathy she perceives in general this year in election 2016.
Yes, and I think the caller makes a great point, and it's something that is certainly worth noting. The top of the ticket races, particularly the presidential race, can have a really big impact on people's enthusiasm at those lower levels. And as the caller indicated, that really is one of the reasons why we're seeing fewer people volunteering for campaigns. Even if they would be interested in doing something like that, the presidential race has put a damper just because of the lack of enthusiasm for candidates on both sides.
Carlene, thanks for the call. You go next to Hemet in Eau Claire. Hi.
I live in Eau Claire. I'm independent, but I wanted to ask the history behind Wisconsin not having a nonpartisan districting commission like Iowa has. What's the problem with that?
Hemet, thanks for the call. Yeah, Iowa and some other states, they take it out of the party's hands. In Wisconsin, we've had single-party control for the Democrats for a while, Republicans for a while. Neither party seem to want to go that way, Tim.
Right, and the problem is that when you are the party in control, there's certainly incentive to keep control of the process. The states themselves have to make that decision. And so it takes a concerted effort on the part of the voters to push for that kind of thing. And so until we see people running for office on that principle and winning, it's going to be difficult because the party in control is going to want to be the one to stay in control.
And Tim, as we wrap up, just in our last minute, a low interest type of race, these assembly and Senate races, do you want to make the case that we should have way higher interest? These things can have a lot of effect on our lives.
Absolutely. Actually, regardless of what people think about the national races, state and local races have more impact on our day-to-day lives, arguably, than the presidential race, as an impact on education, taxes, highways. These are all things day-to-day that people care about. And so caring about local races and voting in local races is just as important as voting for national races.
Presidential races, traditionally high turnout. Do you think that that high turnout is going to sway those local races?
It could. And what's interesting about this year is we may see more turnout driven by dislike for the opposition candidate as opposed to passion for the candidate on the side of the voter. And so I don't expect that we are going to see a turnout that's very much lower, but that's something that we're going to be watching, and it may even change by the time the election comes around, how tired people are of this particular campaign season.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Tim Dale. He's political science professor and chair of that department at UW-La Crosse, talking about the race for control of Wisconsin's legislature. We also heard earlier on this topic from Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau chief. You can follow those and other campaigns at wisconsinvote.org and share your thoughts on legislative elections, redistricting, and so many uncontested elections over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Moving to a new house or an apartment is always a big deal. The packing, the unloading, the loading, changing addresses, and the billing info. And that's just one household. Now think about moving a whole continent.
Australia is on the move, so it's going to have to adjust its GPS coordinates. Why? It's all continental drift. Australia is moving about 2.7 inches each year to the north with a bit of clockwise rotation. It's pretty quick compared to our pokey North American plate. That's only moving about an inch per year.
2.7 inches, it may not sound like a lot, but that means that there's a 5-foot gap between the most recent measurements and GPS systems. Not enough really to mess up your driving directions, but potentially a big deal for a new generation of precise satellite communication systems.
Yeah, now I've used GPS driving around a little, set up on my phone in advance of a trip, and sometimes I've been in places where, you know, it's a little late, you know, take that turn. Oh, I've already gone past the turn. If you're 5 feet off, this could be a big problem if you're driving in Australia.
It could be a big problem, actually, when you think about it. I've had the same thing with GPS. I ended up at the back entrance where there were just wild turkeys and no indoor, you know, as opposed to the front door. So, yeah, these things kind of matter, I guess, in an age of precision.
They matter, especially in the land down under. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.